The Royal Society's Krakatoa Committee, displaying the almost obsessive need for the complete and the comprehensive that was so much a signature of Victorian studies like this, invited responses from the general public. They received wagon loads of material, and they painstakingly catalogued every single report of every atmospheric phenomenon, no matter how trivial, of which they were made aware. Two-thirds of the Society's eventual 494-page report is devoted to the unusual optical phenomena of the atmosphere 1883 to 1886, including twilight effects, coronal appearances, sky haze, coloured suns, moons, etc. 48 further pages give the details of the 800 places where unusual phenomena had been seen and which were organised in their chronological order. The list was actually begun some months before the cataclysm, presumably to give some kind of observational baseline from which the deviations that followed could be measured. So the very first report came from a town called Graaf Reinet in the centre of the South African Tablelands, beginning during the southern winter, with someone noticing the presence of fine sunsets gradually increasing from February to June. The very first eruption of the final paroxysmal cycle, it'll be recalled, actually took place towards the end of May. And thereafter came a cascade of responses from people who had seen or had been told about the Royal Society's announcement in the newspapers. A seemingly endless string of reports is included from a bewildering variety of places and people and ships and lighthouses, all with news of strange phenomena, most of them seen in the skies. A blue moon was spotted by Mr. Horton in Kokulai, Ceylon. The lighthouse keeper at the Chinese city then called Chefu, now Yantai, saw a pale red glow, like fire, in the west. There was a blue sun, seen by a Dr. Earl Flint in Rivas, Nicaragua. Captain Faircloth of the Caribbean Signal Service saw a lurid glare emanating from the sun setting over Nassau in the Bahamas. The scientific journal Nature, which collected dozens of such reports in tandem with the Society, had a first report of a green sun seen in Colombo, and then a letter from a Reverend W.R. Manley, a missionary in Ongole, South India, who saw splendid twilight glows, deep red, more than 1 hour after sunset. And Gerard Manley Hopkins, the Victorian poet and Jesuit priest, then teaching classics at Stonyhurst College, wrote a lengthy essay for Nature, outlining in detail what he had seen, in a style unusual for the normally arid magazine, but easily recognisable to those who knew their Wreck of the Deutschland. The glowing vapour above this, he wrote, was as yet colourless. Then this took a beautiful olive or celadon green, not so vivid as the previous days, and delicately fluted. The green belt was broader than the orange, and pressed down on and contracted it. Above the green, in turn, appeared a red glow, broader and burlier in make. It was softly brindled, and in the ribs or bars the colour was rosier. In the channels where the sky shone through, it was a mallow colour. There were four main kinds of phenomena, all amply evident from these pages and pages of reports. There were the sunsets themselves. There were the vivid and highly unusual colorations of the moon, often blue, sometimes green. The occasional colorations of the sun as well, and very rarely of some of the larger planets. The whitish solar coronas that were frequently seen just before sunset, and the monstrously flaming afterglows. These last afterglows, in fact, turned out generally to be a more dominant and widely noticed feature than the actual sunsets themselves. They are brilliantly hot-looking glows that appear from time to time some way up in the sky, above where the sun has set some minutes before. The geometry of their origin is well known, having been studied assiduously after the eruption. They are caused when the rays of the sun, at an ever-increasing distance from the observer, pass tangentially to an optically unusual layer in the atmosphere. In the case of the afterglow sightings that were made following Krakatoa, the optically unusual layer was the drift of ash. The ash particles absorbing and reflecting and causing a fiery reddening of the red light that is the last to be bent from the source before, thanks to the disappearance of the sun and all of its light now coming from well below the horizon, they eventually vanish altogether. A pattern also emerged swiftly from the Royal Society's massive catalogue of observations. There could be no doubt that the immense cloud of stratospheric ash that spread out from Krakatoa wound itself around the planet in a westerly direction, as one might expect with the world turning eastwards underneath it, and spread both northwards and southwards as it did so. At first, in other words, the blue suns and moons and the fiery afterglows and the bishop's rings and the extraordinary sunsets appeared in the low latitudes, close to the latitude of the volcano. During all of September, in places no farther north than Honolulu, no farther south than Santiago in Chile. But then the cloud spread itself farther afield. By the beginning of October, the phenomena were seen in the Gulf of Mexico, then Nashville, then Buenos Aires, the Canary Islands, Shanghai. By now, 6 weeks after the eruption, the tiny particles were refracting and reflecting and dissipating and dispersing light over fully 62 degrees of latitude, and had spread quite literally half a world away from their birthplace. And so the trend continued. By late October, the amazing sunsets were causing bystanders to gasp and write poetry, to send letters to newspaper editors, and to paint vivid pictures in places like Tasmania, South Africa, and the southern cities of Chile. After which, the cloud of volcanic aerosols, still wafting and widening north and south, performed a strange shiver, and began to move apparently backwards and outwards at the same time, so that sometime around the 23rd of November, after touching western Canada and California, it became apparent not in Alaska, the Aleutians or Hawaii, but in England, Denmark, Turkey, Russia, and coming from the west this time, Siberia. From examining all of the Northern Hemisphere records, including the 500 sunsets of the Chelsea artist Mr. Ashcroft, who started to paint in earnest in November what he saw each evening on the Thames, it appears that countries lying to the east were to be affected later. It looks, in other words, as though the cloud which had in its early days been sliding ever westward was now moving in the opposite direction, as though it was trying to describe a long and lazy spiral across the surface of the earth. Close study of these upper air movements later turned out to be quite crucial for modern meteorology. Analysis of the effects of the Krakatoa eruption, which still continues today, particularly at universities in Hawaii, Rhode Island, Oxford, Auckland and Melbourne, has informed very many areas of science, but in particular it has quite revolutionised the business of weather forecasting, helping it to nudge from its earlier and rather dubious standing as a mere drawing-room fancy into something that approaches the modern science of today. Each time, for instance, that one sees a map of the unfolding patterns of what is called the jet stream, it's well worth remembering that it was the study of the stratospheric movement of the Krakatoa aerosols that led to the understanding of this particular weather-making phenomenon in the first place. The Reverend Bishop in Hawaii seems to have been the first to notice it, and he called the initial spread of ash the equatorial smoke stream. The eruption particles continued to move at about 73 miles per hour, such again was the scientist's exactitude, until, by the end of the year, they settled wherever they were and stayed, moving downwards under gravity's pull with an infinite slowness, and so seeming to hover permanently in the sky, and though having effects not quite as radiantly beautiful as in those first few months, giving the greatest of pleasure to all below who saw them for the next 2 or 3 years. Mr. Ashcroft chronicled the entire long life of these sunsets from his Chelsea studio. They did not, he wrote, entirely fade from view until the early part of 1886. And the spectacle was only the half of it. The cloud reached the environs of New York in December. In the city itself, they saw one thing. "The entire island seemed ablaze," said the New York World. "Great tongues of flame shot up from across the water, reddening the southwestern sky and tinting the Jersey shore with delicate shell colours." The Times, then a less restrained newspaper than today, was only marginally more circumspect. "The clouds gradually deepened to a bloody red hue, and a sanguinary flush was on the sea. The brilliant colours finally faded to a soft roseate." Peter Mark Roget's Thesaurus had been available since 1852, "then into pale pink, and finally died away upon the darkening horizon." Out in the countryside, the results were rather different, and the florid sunsets caused no end of confusion. In Poughkeepsie, 70 miles north along the Hudson Valley, the Daily Eagle noted with wry pleasure on Wednesday the 28th of November, Thanksgiving Eve, that "Poughkeepsie firemen have always been noted for their zeal and promptitude in going to fires, and their efficiency in putting them out, but the effort last night was a little too much for them. The light of an immense conflagration was visible. The bells pealed out vehemently, and the boys ran vigorously down Market to Montgomery, down Montgomery to Riverview Academy they rushed. And when that point was reached, it became evident that the fire was on the other side of the river, and a few moments of cooler reflection convinced them that it was too far to reach, although it could probably last until they got there. Still, there was no means of transport available, and no likelihood of water. The fire being located 91 million miles off, it would have taken the boys somewhere in the neighbourhood of 7 or 8 million years to get there, let them run their best, and their terms would have expired before getting back. The sun is rather a large customer to tackle in the way of fires. It beats a barn to death. We think the boys did well not to run out of hose. Various causes are assigned for the peculiar light in the sky, the main one being the reflection of the rays of the declining sun upon the haze in the horizon. For several days past, also, there's been a peculiar state of atmosphere, which may or may not have something to do with it. The no doubt embarrassed boys, who were duped so nicely by the sunset, belonged to Poughkeepsie's Hose Company No. 6, of 7, better known as the Young America Hose Company, and they were based close enough to the river to be invariably the first called out to deal with a fire in the western end of town. A few days later, trying to assuage their pain, a meteorologist wrote helpfully to a neighbour paper, the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, to say that the same confusing light had been experienced at his end of the state as well, and to offer his opinion whatever it was that prompted the volunteers down in Poughkeepsie to dash off on their horse-drawn pumping engines was caused by a stratum of decomposed vapours in the upper atmosphere. The Poughkeepsie Sunday Courier went further and suggested with some prescience that the apparent reflection of a large conflagration, which called out our fire department, was caused by the sun's rays bending through extremely small water droplets, perhaps mixed with dust and smoke, sifting out the blue and yellow rays. But another correspondent, probably taking down the office copy of Old Moore's Almanac, offered only that the light show, all lumière and no son, was simply an augury of fine anticyclonic weather in the days to come. Given the coming coldness of the season, made much worse by the dust, he could hardly have been more wrong. Certainly the month of November 1883 was a time of unforgettable light shows throughout the northern world, and in addition to the fire spotters believing they had seen a blaze in the western suburbs of Poughkeepsie, there were reports that the fire engines from New Haven, Connecticut, had been sent out too, for much the same reason. There was for a while a curious half-panicked mood about people who had to see these ghastly skies night after night. To some, they seemed almost apocalyptic, often unnerving. It was only when they were explained away as being caused by dust from a distant volcano that people began to relax and to bask in the simple sight of a terrible beauty they would long remember. But it was not to be a permanent fixture, there or anywhere. And then there was the matter of temperature. Batavians noticed the chill immediately. At dawn on the very Monday morning of the eruption, though it was less a dawn, more a vague lightening of a drab, ash-filled gloom, it was colder than records had shown for years, 65 degrees, 15 Fahrenheit degrees lower than normal. People were seen in the streets shivering, though perhaps as much from fear as from a need to keep warm. Dense clouds hung in the air for days afterwards, enveloping the city and an area perhaps 150 miles in diameter in a grey shroud through which the sun's rays could not penetrate. Logic would suggest that a veil of dust particles spreading around the world would in time produce much the same effect, with those places which languished under the sunset-inspiring dust clouds feeling chillier than normal, though on a lesser scale than places nearby. And to an extent they did, though oddly the Royal Society, so assiduous in cataloguing the sound and light shows put out by Krakatoa, never bothered to consider the idea that the world might be cooled down by all the particles in the upper air. The Society's editors present a catalogue of the world's barometric pressures, but none of the world's ambient temperatures. Those studies had to wait until much, much later. A rather puzzling omission, considering the Times' enthusiasm for climate-related studies, and one that's never been satisfactorily explained. And when these studies of temperature came, the first one was carried out in 1913, a second in 1982, both found that, as expected, there had indeed been a worldwide drop in temperature. It had amounted on average to about 1 Fahrenheit degree, and it had occurred, according to all surviving records, at a time which appeared to be coincident with the eruption of Krakatoa. What has not been established, and what still concerns the scientific community, is which came first. Did the eruption lower the world's temperature, or did a lowering of the world temperature because of some other reason, perhaps, unthinkable though it seems, somehow prompt the crust to undergo stress and strain and crack, and a rash of volcanoes to explode? There's no doubt there is a correlation, a definite link. Benjamin Franklin was the first to notice it, and he told an audience at the Manchester Literary and Philosophical Society that the dry fogs that had seemed to cool the European summer of 1783 and had made the ensuing winter exceptionally bitter were almost certainly the work of dust in the air. He had examined the volcanic records and found a fissure volcano called Lakagígar, or Hekla in Iceland, that had erupted earlier in the year, curiously exactly a century before Krakatoa. It had produced great clouds of dust for week after week, and which tumbled up high into the atmosphere. This, he declared, must surely be the culprit. The infamous eruption in 1815 of Tambora, on the Indonesian island of Sumbawa, 700 miles east of Krakatoa, ejected twice the volume of material into the atmosphere, 11 cubic miles of rock and ash and dust, compared with Krakatoa's 6. The devastation it caused locally was profound, supposedly 50,000 dead, an entire language, Tambora, extinguished, an entire island rendered uninhabitable for years. But its climatic effects were astounding, for it lowered the world's temperature by almost 1 centigrade degree on average. For every day when the normal temperature might be 33 degrees Fahrenheit, just above freezing, the temperature in the year after Tambora would be 31 degrees, and ice would have formed on every pond and, more fatally, in every newborn crop and flower and hatching egg. So in New England, the farmers claimed that 1816 was the year without summer. There were frosts as far south as New Jersey in late May, in upper New England in June and July, and the growing season was slashed from the usual 160 days to 70. Soup kitchens opened in Manhattan. Livestock had to be fed on fish carried over from the Atlantic seaports. 1816 still remembered also as the mackerel year. There were crop failures, the last great subsistence crisis of the Western world, some called it, and as a result there was emigration to the Western states. No small number of today's Californians can rightly lay responsibility for their being Californians squarely at the door of the proximate cause of that year's ruinous cold back east, Tambora, a volcano unknown to most of them and 10,000 miles away. Although there was migration into California from Europe, in Newfoundland quite the reverse took place, oddly. Migrants were sent back east across the ocean because in Newfoundland there wasn't enough for them to eat. And yet back in Europe, it was just as bad. The weather for 1816 is the worst recorded, with low temperatures stretching as far south as Tunisia. French grapes could not be harvested until November. The German wheat crop failed entirely, and prices for flour had doubled in a year. In some places there were reports of famine, and in others there were riots and mass migrations. The diaries and newspapers of the day present a litany of miseries. It's said that Byron composed his most miserable poem, Darkness. Morn came and went, and came, and brought no day. Under the influence of that dismal year, and Mary Shelley may have composed Frankenstein, while gripped by a similarly unseasonable melancholy. Nowadays, sophisticated instruments and the measurements they take have usurped the role of anecdote and diary. Ice cores show minute layers of ash or increases in sulfuric acid as indicators of eruptive material in the atmosphere. And there is stunting of tree rings, the creation of a frost ring in trees that have suffered through an exceptionally cold winter. The examination of deep ice cores and of such trees as were living in the 19th century have confirmed what the stories had long suggested, that eruptions of any of the world's larger volcanoes tend to coincide with periods of a cooling of the earth, some of the periods longer and with a very much lowered temperature, others shorter and with less of a fall in the mercury. The precise, decisive factors are still not quite agreed. Tambora's eruption of clouds of ash coincided with a cooling of the world in 1815 and 1816, and so in 1883 did the appearance of the clouds of ash from Krakatoa. The most tragic of cargoes to move out from the volcano happened also to be the slowest. The audible sounds and the unhearable shock waves may have sped away at more than 700 miles an hour, and the dust may have wandered across the globe at more than 70. The immense rafts of floating pumice that drifted away from where they splashed into the seas around Krakatoa made it as far to the southeast coast of Africa. But they didn't make landfall for more than a year, travelling half a mile each hour at best. And when they did arrive and were found washed up on the shores, they were discovered in some horrifying cases to have transported skeletons along with them, bringing as passengers the unidentifiable remains of some of the unfortunate thousands of Javanese and Sumatrans, Dutchmen and Chinese who had perished. Pumice is one of the better known byproducts of volcanism. The most widely used products are, of course, volcanically produced rocks used for building stone, which range in type from either the dark basalts and gabbros, such as were used for making the spires of Cologne Cathedral, to the paler andesitic rocks, as are to be found in the temple lanterns all around Kyoto. Volcanic soils, especially a group called andesols, are uncommonly rich in minerals, and in the attractive phrasing of the Encyclopedia of Volcanoes, have nourished many ancient civilizations. And there are scores of the most ordinary everyday items that have incorporated volcanic products, particularly a highly absorbent mineral derived from weathered ash and called bentonite in their manufacture. Batteries, surfboards, refrigerators and air conditioners generally make use of ash invisibly, while the cheap building material known as breeze block makes no secret of its origins, crushed up coke, cinders, furnace clinker and, in places where it's readily available, finely ground up pumice and volcanic ash. Pumice, of course, also resides in many an old-fashioned bathroom, sitting beside the loofah and the scrubbing brush. It's pleasantly abrasive, and because of the high proportion of gas bubbles that are caught in it before it solidifies in flight, it is of such low density that it floats quite readily. Makers of distressed denim fabrics also like to use it in their giant washing machines, where it brushes softly against the cloth, whitening and ageing it in a way that apparently finds favour with youngsters. But these more benign uses of pumice tend to shroud the awful truth about the immense tonnage of it that was released by Krakatoa. The headmistress of a mission school in Zanzibar, off the east coast of Africa, wrote to the Royal Society in response to the appeal to report that, about the third week in July, 1884, the boys were much amused by finding on the beach stones which would float, evidently pumice stone. The lady who was with them also noticed that there were a quantity of human skulls and bones all along the beach at high water mark. These were quite clean and had no flesh remaining on them and were found at intervals of a few yards, two or three lying close together. The closer to the volcano, the thicker the rafts of pumice, of course. On the west coast of the island of Kosrae, in what is now Pacific Micronesia, huge plates of pumice 16 inches thick were hauled from the beach early in 1884. These were covered with barnacles, and many were accompanied by the roots of enormous trees, with extra pumice lumps caught up in their roots, helping them to stay afloat. These trees, torn up and floated 3,000 miles to the east, were presumably parts of Krakatoa's old forests, the same forests which had been noted and painted by Captain Cook's homebound expedition in 1780, and those which the Sundanese boat builders had been cutting when the first eruptions had begun in May, and which prompted them to flee for their lives. The crews of ships moving through fields of pumice, such as those acres in extent that were encountered by one vessel coming into the Sunda Strait from Australia in January, were struck by the peculiar sound of the bow slicing through the rock. There was no real noise, just a soft sort of crushing sound. And all the passing ships did their best to avoid desecrating the terrible cargo that the pumice rafts all too often carried. A crewman on the vessel Samoa, which was heading southwestwards off into the Indian Ocean, wrote of the nightmarish unreality of such encounters. "For 2 days after passing Anya, we passed through masses of dead bodies, hundreds and hundreds of them striking the ships on both sides, groups of 50 and 100, all packed together, most of them naked. We passed a great deal of wreckage, but of course we cannot tell if any vessels were lost. We also passed bedding chests and a number of white bodies all dressed like sailors with sheath knives on them. For 10 days we went through fields of pumice stone." what the seamen on the Samoa and on the Bothwell Castle and on the Loudon and the Berbice and the Charles Bell and the Kadiri and a score of other ships beside that scoured the Sunda Strait during those weeks in late August and September and October witnessed does not bear too much repeating, so awful is what they have to say. Most reports were much more dreadful than this, which was published in a letter to the Times from a correspondent writing from Batavia in October. The British ship Bay of Naples had called at these islands and had reported that on the same day, when 120 miles from Java's first point, during the volcanic disturbances, she encountered carcasses of animals, including even those of tigers, and about 150 human corpses, of which 40 were those of Europeans, besides enormous trunks of trees borne along by the current. Yet it is what they did not see that remains to take the longer view of the greater real significance. For what they did not see was this. They did not see the half-mile-high pointed peak of Krakatoa. They did not see it smouldering menacingly in the aftermath of what it had done, as most volcanoes are prone to do, usually, whether named Vesuvius or St. Helens or Pinatubo or Unzen or Etna, a volcano explodes, and in doing so causes manifold devastation and death, and then simply stands there, raging and smoking ever less fiercely, presiding with a titanic smugness over the ruin it has so lately made. But, uniquely in much of volcanic history, Krakatoa did no such thing. For Krakatoa, quite simply, had gone. 6 cubic miles of rock offer, most of the island's great bulk, had just vanished, either blown into the sky or collapsed into the sea, and with the most thunderous roar and with the greatest loss of life ever recorded in certain history. For so long before that, Krakatoa had been an island of no consequence. It had been little more than a genial, easily recognised sailor's companion, spotted off the bow of an approaching ship, a sea mark that would always help guide any navigator who was feeling his way up or down this most vital waterway between Java and Sumatra. It was that old island with a pointed mountain, and nothing more. Now, in the middle of the summer of 1883, it had suddenly and without much warning gone totally berserk, sent the sea berserk as well, and then had essentially vanished. Not vanished in name, perhaps, not vanished from memory either, and recently, and in much the same form, reborn, as we shall see. But in August 1883, this inconsequential little island went mad and disappeared. The reasons just why this happened, as it did, how it did, and when it did, have occupied the minds of a great community of geologists around the world for all the long years since. Part 4. The Explanations. Why did Krakatoa happen? Why, indeed and more generally, do volcanoes do what they do? Why does the terra firma, upon which we so confidently and innocently secure all our lives, sometimes and so capriciously tear itself open and cause such fearful destruction as it does so? To those caught up in such a moment of appalling terror, such as the thousands whose lives were wrecked in 1883, it all must seem a most monstrous injustice, a terrible cheek perpetrated by the earth and its presiding deities. Krakatoa is a stark reminder of the truth of Will Durant's famous aphorism that civilization exists by geologic consent, subject to change without notice. Yet geology, which is an unemotional and rational science, allows us to step back from our shock and dismay at such events, to accept a longer view, and to be awed by something rather different, that despite her seemingly cruel caprices, this planet in fact enjoys by and large an extraordinarily fortunate situation. The simple, very obvious features of the Earth, its location in space, its size, the processes that led to its creation, processes which include the very volcanic events that took all those lives west of Java, happen to have been suited perfectly, when taking this long view, to the sustenance and maintenance of organic life. To victims of a volcanic eruption like this, of course, the very reverse must seem true, but consider location, for instance. Planet Earth is sighted just close enough to the star around which it orbits to derive only benefits from the latter's infernal solar heat. It is neither so close as to risk the boiling of its oceans and the loss of its water into outer space by photodissociation in the upper atmosphere, nor is it so far away that all its present liquid water will remain uselessly and inconsumably frozen. The size of the Earth is spot on, too. Thanks to its moderate size, its gravitational pull is just right. It is strong enough to overcome in particular the escape velocities of the molecules both of water and carbon dioxide, which means that we have a sheltering canopy, a benevolently situated greenhouse, even though this is a word with more negative associations today, that first allowed life's building blocks to be assembled and then ensured that the fragile living entities so made could be cosseted against the perilous radiations from outer space. And then there are the volcanoes, just the right number, of just the right size, for our own good, in fact. The deep heat reservoir inside the Earth is not so hot, for instance, as to cause ceaseless and utterly unbearable volcanic activity on the surface. The amount of heat and thermal decay within the Earth happens to be just perfect for allowing convection currents to form and to turn over and over in the Earth's mantle, and for the solid continents that lie above them to slide about according to the complicated and beautiful mechanisms of plate tectonics. Plate movement and convection and the volcanic activity that is their constant handmaid may not seem to the victims of eruptions and tidal waves to be in any way benign or to be good for the planet as a whole, and yet, taking the longer view once again, they most certainly are. The water, carbon dioxide, carbon and sulphur that are so central to the making and maintenance of organic life are all being constantly recycled by the world's volcanoes, which were also the probable origins of the Earth's atmosphere in the very first place. It is not merely that volcanoes bring fertile volcanic soils or useful minerals to the surface. What is much more crucial is their role in the process of bringing from the secret storehouses of the inner Earth the elements that allow the outer Earth, the biosphere and the lithosphere, to be so vibrantly alive. Other of our neighbour planets are, so far as is known, volcanically lifeless. They are also, on all the available evidence, more or less biologically lifeless, and that is quite probable, at least in part, because they are so volcanically dead. Only Io, one of Jupiter's many moons, seems to sport any significant number of volcanoes. Spectacular sulphur-rich fountains of magma have been seen spouting on its surface. But there's no suggestion of the existence of plates, nor of any movement of the solid crust, either on Io or anywhere else on any planet or moon known to exist between Mars and Pluto. The vigorous business of plate movement appears neither to exist on planets that are hotter than our own, nor on the surface of those that are much more frozen and more deeply dead. But it is the movement of the plates and the internal storms that rage below and cause them to slip beneath or alongside one another or tear themselves apart along their suture lines that is the driving force behind our Earth's highly unusual degree of volcanism. Plate movement, as well as shaping the planet's topography, also creates most of the very volcanism that is central to its life. Plate tectonics, in other words, is the key to it all. And any examination of just why Krakatoa happened as it did and how it did must inevitably now refer to this newly minted catalogue of knowledge about the workings of the Earth. It was, of course, not always so. In the distant past, whenever the Earth behaved with terrible and unanticipated violence, mankind could do little more than wonder, horror-struck, at the sheer effrontery of it. In very early times, this wonderment was answered inevitably, mainly by religion and the making of myths. Volcanoes were hills occupied by temperamental gods. They could be appeased by frequent sacrifice. The appeasing flesh could either be that of a young human, a small child thrown every 25 years into the crater of a particular Nicaraguan volcano, for instance, would guarantee its quietude, or an animal. The Javanese today toss chickens into the crater of Mount Bromo. Superstition plays an important role in East Indian attitudes towards their volcanoes still. The ancient Romans and Greeks then hammered some kind of order into their beliefs, as might be expected. The idea of the existence of Hades, the nature of such gods as Pluto and Vulcan, the character of titanic monsters like the fearsome, wild-eyed and flaming-tongued Typhon, were all connected with the wayward behaviour of an Earth that all then knew had a terrible and dangerously hot interior. It was no coincidence that the gateway to Hades believed by the ancients to be in the Earth's centre, was the Romans' most notorious local volcano, Mount Etna. And the phrase "sailing to Sicily" was for a while a euphemism for entering the fiery furnaces of the devil's domain. The seers of the classical world were on rather shakier ground when it came to deciding just why, other than for divine reasons, there was just so much heat inside the earth. The Greeks, the philosophers Anaxagoras and Aristotle in particular, favoured the human analogy of trapped wind, with the friction of the escaping wind causing the generation of heat, a sort of volcanic vindaloo. The Romans, on the other hand, and among them most notably Lucius Seneca, favoured the notion that the heat came from the combustion of a vast inner earth storehouse of sulphur, and in some Roman poetry of the time this idea extended to the burning of deeply buried reservoirs of alum, coal and tar. This idea that volcanoes were the consequences of the steady burning of a finite store of earthly combustibles exerted a grip on the scientific mind for centuries. Then, as chemistry developed as a science, so its innumerable secrets offered themselves as the favoured sources for all the necessary heat, and were widely accepted as doing so. During the 17th and 18th centuries, a great many seers, Isaac Newton among them, believed that so-called exothermic chemical reactions were the answer. By 1807, when the Geological Society of London, the world's oldest such body, was founded, the oxidation of newly discovered alkaline metals, such as sodium and potassium, was thought to be an answer. Even as late as the 1920s, there were two now notoriously blinkered scientists who clung to what might seem today's quite fatuous chemical theories. One of them, Arthur Lewis Day, proposed in 1925 that volcanic heat was due to a series of complex chemical reactions between gases, and he won support from the redoubtable and influential Sir Harold Jeffreys, while at the same time dismissing volcanism generally as a phenomenon that was merely local and occasional, not perpetual and worldwide. However, in tandem with all those chemists and physicists who for so long had such an influence on geophysical thinking, there were also other natural philosophers, René Descartes most notable among them, who started out on what would prove to be the right track. In the mid-17th century, Descartes, better known for his cogito ergo sum and for his legacy of Cartesian coordinates, came up with a quite revolutionary idea that the Earth originated by way of gravitational attraction and gaseous condensation, that heat was an essential primordial component of this process, and that its slow decay resulted in the Earth having three internal concentric parts, a highly dense and incandescent liquid core, a half-cooled plastic central region, and a cold, solid, and comparatively light crust. Moreover, there was ample primordial heat left over from the creation process to power all known volcanoes for a very, very long time. The subsequent advent of the science of field geology, the furious debates that went on between Neptunists, who believed all rocks to have precipitated out of a primeval ocean, and Plutonists, who saw countless of them as having their origins in melting and magma, belongs to another story, temptingly diverting, though the various interlocking sagas may be. In essence, though, the mystery that occupied most minds for most of the late 19th and early 20th centuries was simply why rocks melt. What combination was it of physics and chemistry, of depth, of heat, and of the presence or absence of water in the mix of minerals that would lead a rock to become plastic and mobile and molten, and then to emerge on the surface and cool and harden and solidify back into rock once again? The chemist and the chemistry that sought to answer questions about the makeup of the earth in earlier times have been overtaken by the physics and the physicists, seeking to do much the same in recent years. And although the physics answered much of the detail involved, many of the fundamental questions remain doggedly, in essence, unresolved. Or at least they did, until that memorable July day in 1965, when, as I've explained in an earlier chapter, the soft-spoken and self-effacing Canadian geologist J. Tuzo Wilson managed to combine both chemistry and physics of the Earth into one, inaugurating the science of plate tectonics. In doing so, he launched a brand new and all-encompassing global theory that would offer the answer to almost everything volcanic that had ever been wondered at. Uniquely in the solar system, this planet sports a crust that is, by virtue of this process, being constantly destroyed and regenerated, an ever-mobile chemical factory where materials that exist in solid, liquid, and gaseous states are being recycled endlessly. They are being burst out from the middle of oceanic plates by a process newly understood that allows upwelling materials to melt without heat being added to them, to melt simply because the pressure on them is being relieved by their being convected upwards and outwards towards the atmosphere. There are volcanoes here in these mid-crustal ridges, big but not especially explosive volcanoes, mountains that ooze basalt, like those in Hawaii and Iceland, the Azores and the Rift Valleys of East Africa. They are the stuff of research and fascination in their own right. But they are the distaff side of the volcano of this kind. They are the alpha to Krakatoa's omega, the mid-plate reciprocal to all that goes on at the plate's edges. They are the other side of the story. For the materials that rise up in the middle, along with whatever they sweep before them on their way, are in due course swept down again at the peripheries of the plates. They are swept down by a process that is most crucial of all, and which, though an essential part of earthly regeneration, also leads directly to the making of highly explosive, dramatic and deadly arc volcanoes like Krakatoa. Colloquially, the phenomenon that exists at these plate edges is known among geophysicists and volcanologists as the subduction factory, and Krakatoa stands front and centre in one of the largest and most complicated of these extraordinary world-shaping entities. The factories and the subduction zones that underpin them are essentially coextensive. It probably bears repeating that each of the zones is where one of the world's many heavy oceanic plates slowly collides with and slides, buckling as it does so, underneath one of the many lighter and thicker continental plates. The zones are very long and very thin. If unravelled, they'd extend for about 19,000 miles, but they're rarely more than 60 miles wide. The total area of the subducting world's assembly lines amounts to thus about 1 million square miles, about the size of Greenland in total, or the American Confederate South, or Argentina. Enclosed within the zones and formed and allowed to grow and then destroyed or mutated or otherwise dramatically affected by the processes going on inside them are about 1,400 of the world's 1,500 historically active land volcanoes. 94% of all visible volcanoes, in other words, stand within subduction zones. A mere handful of countries, Indonesia, Japan, the United States, Russia, Chile, the Philippines, New Guinea, New Zealand, Nicaragua, chief among them, and in that order, play host to most of them. These nine countries are home to more than 9 out of every 10 volcanoes that either are liable to erupt today or have done so in recent history. The most readily recognisable subduction zones are those that enfold the Pacific Ocean. As a reasonably familiar example, consider that which runs along the western edge of South America, and which has created the chain we know as the Andes. This is where the heavy basaltic Nazca Plate, as it's known, collides with the lighter granitic and sedimentary rock South American Plate. It does so simply because it is, at the same time, splitting away from its neighbour, the Pacific Plate, along what is called the East Pacific Rise, close to where the Isla de Pascua, Easter Island, is hoisted above the ocean surface. The subduction factory that results is a classic of its kind, creating dozens of volcanoes, running from the Andean peaks of Ruiz and Galera in the north in Colombia, via Chacana, Cotopaxi and Sangay in Ecuador, Huayna-Putina in Peru, Lascar in Chile, Tlaima and Villarica on the frontier between Argentina and Chile, and at the southern tip of the continent, Monte Burney and Cerro Hudson, this last volcano erupting massively in 1991. All told, there are 67 volcanoes that have been manufactured by the processes of this one subduction zone. And since there are 4,000 miles separating northern Colombia from southern Chile, and since there is a sort of serrated regularity to the Andes, that means that there's more or less one volcano piercing the sky every 60 miles. Much the same number of volcanoes, with similar intervals between them, are to be found at the other subduction factories around the Pacific, in Alaska and the Aleutian Islands, in the Kamchatka Peninsula, in Japan and the Kuril Islands, and most notably, in the most volcanic part of the world, the great subduction zone that stretches 3,000 miles from the northern tip of Sumatra to what is called the Bird's Head on the northwestern tip, the West Irian side, of the island of New Guinea. In this most immense factory, there are at least 87 volcanoes making up much of the archipelago that politics has lately chosen to call Indonesia and the Philippines. Indonesia itself has and has had more volcanoes and more volcanic activity than any other political entity on Earth in all recorded history. It is a country that is defined by its place at the heart of a subduction zone. It's essentially made up of volcanoes and precious little else. On the island of Java alone, there are 21 volcanoes that remain fully active. Their eruptions are invariably spectacular and terribly dangerous, and because a very great number of people live and work near the volcanoes, not least because the volcanic soil, thanks to the recycling mentioned earlier, is nutritious and ideally suited for farming, are the cause of a dismaying number of deaths. The Earth fashioned three of the five greatest volcanoes of historic time in this one gigantic factory. The largest the world has ever known was made there, Mount Toba, which erupted 74,000 years ago in what is now northern Sumatra. It had a volcanic explosivity index of 8, the highest on a scale that is now universally used to classify all eruptions, save for those which merely ooze lava without exploding. Toba's humongous explosion, this curious adjective is now officially used to describe giant volcanoes, the equivalent of the cyclonic sea state that is these days termed phenomenal, left behind it an immense lake, 50 miles long and 15 wide, with the sheer caldera cliffs rising 800 feet straight out of the water. The eruption left layers of dust 18 inches thick on the ocean floor 1,500 miles away, and must have placed a severe crimp on the development of such humans as were struggling for existence in those times. It must have lowered the world's ambient temperature by many degrees and made even more harsh a climate that was already in the midst of changing into yet another ice age. The eruption of Tambora in 1815 in this same subduction zone is reckoned the second greatest in history, with an explosivity index of 7. This index, which was first created at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, is based on two features: the amount of material that is ejected in an explosion and the height to which it is hurled through the atmosphere. These two factors are clearly observable in modern eruptions. They are also deducible from the records of the past. Even though there were no literate eyewitnesses to Toba, and very few to Tambora, which has to be the principal reason neither has lingered in the public consciousness, while Krakatoa clearly has, the total mass that was ejected from each eruption can be calculated with some precision from an examination of the local geological record, and the distribution of the ash falls far away on the seabed can suggest with fair accuracy the heights to which the columns rose into the sky. Third in the list is Taupo in New Zealand, which erupted in 180 AD, hugely. And the fourth is Novarupta in Alaska, better known as Katmai, on the landward end of the Aleutian chain. It erupted in 1912. This latter was the largest recent eruption on the North American mainland, but because of its remoteness, it was little noticed except by what, in terms of calderas and domes and frozen lakes, it left behind. And then, fifth in the list of all volcanoes known, with a VEI of 6.5, with more than 6 cubic miles of rock and ash and pumice and dust hurled dozens of miles into the lower stratosphere, with sounds heard 3,000 miles away, with tidal waves of enormous force and height, with shock waves that ran 4 times to the far side of the world and almost 3 times back, and with more people killed and more livelihoods ruined than by any other eruption in world history, comes Krakatoa. 7 weeks after the eruption, when the dust had cleared, the Netherlands government ordered Dr. Rogier Verbeek and his colleagues to investigate exactly what had happened. The team of 4 took off in the government hopper barge, the Kediri, on the 11th of October, and spent the following 2 weeks examining every possible aspect of the now seemingly dead remnants of the mountain. The orgy of self-destruction was more than amply evident. It was, Verbeek wrote later, the most interesting eruption witnessed by the human race until now. but very little of the original mountain was left to see. The southern quarter of the island remained, but sliced open as with a vertical carving knife, so that the original peak of Rakata looked from the south almost the same, but with everything to its north missing. The exposed northern face of Rakata was almost perfectly vertical, an in-cross section when viewed from the north quite perfectly triangular, and pierced with vertical lines and radiating systems of lava-filled dikes and sills and plugs of newly formed rock, all covered with several feet of grey pumice dust, so that it looked from afar exactly as it was, a perfect cross-section, as one might see in a teaching chart of a one-time volcano that had been blasted in half and into oblivion. But at least the summit of Rakata was, more or less, still there. The two northern peaks of Krakatoa, the summits known as Danan and Perbawatan, were to the expedition's awestruck fascination no longer anywhere to be seen, nor was the little skerry of andesite known, because of its shape, as the Polish hat. It had quite vanished, presumably vaporised in that one paroxysmal instant. The very opposite had happened to the two small islands, Lang and Valaten, which had once enfolded Krakatoa like a pair of parentheses. Rather than vanishing into thin air, these two now appeared to be very much larger than they had before. Their beaches, it turned out, had since the eruption become choked and swollen with enormous amounts of stranded pumice. Larger they may have been, but the essential difference about their appearance, as maritime parentheses, was that now they were enfolding and bracketing nothing. Between them was just a huge expanse of empty, lifeless sea, with the immense broken fang of Rakata Peak rising alone straight out of the ocean as a reminder of what once had been there. The sea to the immediate north of the Rakata cliff was very deep, nearly 1,000 feet. Clearly, an enormous new caldera had been created. Almost the entire volcano had collapsed into an immense void below, and the cliff of Rakata, neatly bisected where it had been shorn off, was all that remained to the south of the collapse. Off to the northeast, two entirely new little islands had risen from the waves, and were named Steers and Kalmeyer Islands, because they were composed of little more than stranded rafts of soft pumice. They would be eroded back to sea level in a very short order, and on today's charts there are just warnings of patches of discoloured water 15 feet deep, suggesting where they used to be. Back in 1885, when Verbeek wrote his official report, there were only the vaguest explanations of just why all of this might have happened. It was easy enough to describe what had happened. The science of descriptive volcanology was in any case well advanced and had been for many years. But when the volcanologists of the day came to explain the reasons for the violent behaviour of their charges, as true for every volcano in the world as it was for Krakatoa, there was very little understanding of the processes of the world to offer them a basis for coming up with any kind of theory. After all, only a few decades before, many believed that basalt and flows of lava were simply precipitates from the sea. Until 1857, many geologists thought that volcanoes were caused by the bulging upwards of horizontal flows of lava, not that they had been built vertically by the discharge of their own products. And at the time of Krakatoa's eruption, Alfred Wegener, who first came up with the idea of continental drift that was to lead to the theory of plate tectonics, and who might well have set the bewildered community of volcanologists off in the right direction, was only 3 years old. And so, while in all the official reports and learned papers about the event there was plenty of description of the ruin and dismay that Krakatoa had caused, and though there was much speculation about why the volcano exploded with the violence it displayed, there was next to nothing by way of sensible wondering about the larger mechanisms that might have triggered it. This was true for Verbeek in his report of 1886. He spent countless pages describing in detail clogged pipes and steam vents and collapses of central parts of the main volcano. What he concluded did display a remarkable prescience, in that he thought that a good deal of the vanished volcano had foundered into the sea rather than had been blasted into the atmosphere. He suggested that the Plinian violence of the explosion was a result of seawater mixing suddenly with the magma and flashing over, turning into superheated steam in a gigantic and uncontrollable explosion that is these days given the somewhat less than attractive name of a phreatomagmatic eruption. But he never tried to step back and wonder why Krakatoa was where it was and why it did what it did in the first place. The same was also true for John Judd, president of the Geological Society of London and the author of a then classic work, Volcanoes, in 1881. He too wrote eloquently of the way in which hot magma and seawater mixed, and of how pumice was created by a lowering of the magma's melting point by the addition of the water. But once again, he missed the central point. He never even tried to grapple with the central issue. Why Krakatoa? The last popular book on the subject, Krakatoa by Rupert Furneaux, was written in 1964. Even then, still lacking any solid theory which might account for the world's inner processes, the author could only really describe what a volcano was, a hole in the ground through which hot gas, molten material and fragmentary products rise to the surface, where volcanoes were to be found, and to name the kinds of materials that came from them. And when it came to the specific case of Krakatoa, which was described over many pages, and with a quite magical literary skill, the author turns almost desperate. The book begins to speak in terms of the demon going in to press the attack, his searching fingers boring into the defences and the pent-up energies of time and his primeval forces readying themselves to do battle. One can hardly blame Mr. Furneaux. Neither he nor anyone else had an inkling of what really caused Krakatoa, and that was hardly his fault. He wrote his book in 1964. The theory of plate tectonics didn't come about until 1965. He was simply a year too early. But once plate tectonic theory was in place, all that changed. Nowadays, there's a ready explanation for what happened and why. Essentially, the same explanation accounts for the eruption of Toba at the northwestern end of the subduction zone and for Tambora at its eastern end and for all the other volcanoes in between. Krakatoa erupted because of what happens when two plates collide. On what takes place specifically when the northbound Australian oceanic plate collides, as it has been doing for many millions of years past and as it continues to do today, with that part of the Asian plate that, for the sake of simplicity, we will call by the name it enjoys today, Sumatra. As it hits, and because it is cold and made of the heavier, darker, less acidic suite of rocks that underlie all oceans, so it begins to sink below the warmer and lighter rocks of which Sumatra and all other continents are made. As it sinks, it takes with it, downward, the small, wedge-shaped sliver of continental rocks that it either scratched or smeared off the Sumatran edge, along with some of the sands and clays that had accumulated on the Sumatran coast, and with the water that was trapped chemically in these, as well as with a fair amount of atmospheric air and seawater besides. This entire geological cocktail, an amalgam of cold and heavy basalt from the plate, granite-like rocks from the Sumatran crust, sands, clays, limestones, and vast quantities of air and water, then plummets downwards. And as it does, so everything suddenly changes. Water is the crucial ingredient in this process. Not only does water lubricate the motion of the plates and helps the subduction continue, but even in very tiny amounts, water's presence lowers the temperature at which the rocks of the mantle will begin to melt. And since the water also lowers the density of the wedge-shaped mélange that is being swept and smeared downwards too, the molten rock that is being created below it finds that the rocks above it have suddenly become, thanks again to the water, less dense, less rigid, less strong. They've become, in other words, a perfect exit route for the partly melted rock below to rush upwards, to melt even further because of the decompression mentioned earlier, and then, with their dissolved carbon dioxide and water vapour suddenly turning back into gas and frothing out of solution, the whole mass rushes up and out as a torrent of phenomenal explosivity into the unsuspecting open air as a gigantic and classical subduction zone volcano. That is why Krakatoa exploded. As to why it exploded so powerfully and so very noisily, this entirely different debate continues apace today. There are some clues. The geography of the islands indicates, for example, that there was once an ancient super Krakatoa, and that it, at some unspecified time in the past, exploded and collapsed into itself, leaving behind a caldera. The parenthesis islands of Lang and Verlaten were clearly the caldera walls, the cliffs at the edge of the very old volcano. The volcano that succeeded this then had three distinct peaks, Rakata, Danann, and Purbawatan, each an exit passage for a gigantic magma chamber that clearly existed deep below the region. So, There can be little doubt from this simple evidence alone that the 1883 Krakatoa existed above a large chamber of magma, and that with the three exit pipes above it weakening its roof, it had a propensity, in times of violent stress, to collapse. The question that has occupied the minds of many specialists in recent years is simply this. Was it the fact that seawater managed to get into this chamber at the moment of collapse that was the primary cause of the deafening explosion and the tidal waves, or was it simply one contributory factor, and some other process was at work to make things even more dramatic than that one process could produce? A series of experiments performed in pressure vessels in a laboratory in Australia has suggested that other factors were at work, but that they were complex and subtle. They suggest that a pulse of fresh basalt from deeper in the earth may have been unexpectedly injected into the base of the magma chamber, that this new pulse heated the existing magma above it, causing a violent convection current and the sudden frothing of even more gas, and the sudden breach of the chamber roof. This idea of magma mixing has lately taken hold. There may be processes going on even more deeply within the subduction zone contributed to the might of the Krakatoa event. And then, finally, there is the overall sighting of Krakatoa, halfway between Java and Sumatra. It lies directly above what might be called the hinge point, around which the two islands are very slowly swinging, the strait ever-widening, the islands turning like the pages of a northward-closing book, Sumatra moving to the northeast, Java to the north, Krakatoa right in the middle. There is certainly a complex network of faults in the Sunda Strait, their existence being one of the reasons that there's a strait there in the first place, why there's an absence of island mass there. Slowly, very slowly, science is trying to make some sense out of the complexity of it all. Geophysicists in Troy, New York, have spent recent years placing a rash of global positioning system receivers on the nearby islands and have found that all manner of tiny movements are taking place, that the main subduction zone continues to creep away, as it has done for millions of years, but the tiny little sideways jogs are taking place too, small weakenings, creations of a blizzard of tiny faults that make the region into one of the most remarkable of geological laboratories, a fascinating study, even if Krakatoa had never existed. But it does exist, and it will play tricks on the world once again, and before very much longer. The processes that led to the events of August 1883 are unstoppable. There is a subduction factory of monumental proportions to the south and east of Sumatra. It is uniquely sited around and beneath the small island that lies on the hinge point between Sumatra and Java. The island is surrounded by the volatile waters of the sea, water which causes mayhem if it gets within a mile of boiling magma. The island itself is surrounded by countless small faults and zones of weakness, and by a raft of components of basic rock, of acidic rock, of sedimentary rock, that are twisting and turning every which way under a barrage of stresses and strains that exist more notably here than anywhere else on Earth. Small wonder, indeed, that there's only one Krakatoa. The place where it blew itself apart is so geologically dangerous that one can almost imagine there being room for a dozen more. They counted their dead, and they buried them where they could, which was usually where they found them. The Dutch officials reacted with commendable speed, burying bodies at the rate of several hundred a day, drenching the swamps with carbolic acid, pulling down wreckage, setting cleansing fires. The king back in Holland opened a fund. Dutch mothers sent blankets and tents and food. A flotilla of ships travelled east to see what could be done. Anna Wilson's Great World Circus staged benefit performances in Batavia before packing up and going home, taking their distressed little elephant with them. The process of rebuilding began, with the Fourth Point Lighthouse at Anya, newly made with iron plates, hurried back into operation to ensure the safety of the commercial shipping lanes, a symbolic beginning of the rebirth. The cable lines to and from West Java and South Sumatra were repaired. The aid workers came to town. The charities set up shop. The scientists fanned out to investigate, to report, to recommend. But in time, they all went home again, to deal with other problems and to answer fresher questions. They left the coastal people of Java and Sumatra and those islanders of shore dwellers known as the Bantanese among their patched-up ruins, and in time they forgot all about them. They didn't stop to wonder where these people might eventually look for support, sustenance, and succour. Perhaps they should have done, for it turned out that not a few of these unhappy, dispossessed, and totally traumatized people eventually looked to their West, to Mecca, and to the ever-benevolent power of their Islamic religion to answer their needs. This was a political and religious consequence of the disaster, a consequence entirely unanticipated by the ruling Dutch colonists, that was to have the most profound and longest-lasting fallout for the Indies, for Europe, and for the world beyond. Chapter 9. Rebellion of a Ruined People. The central market in Serang, an unremarkable crossroads town a few miles inland from the little pepper port of Banten, sells everything and attracts everyone. On Tuesday, the 2nd of October, 1883, 5 weeks after the eruption and with the dead of Java and Sumatra still being buried, and the ruins of the towns and the villages on the coast still being cleared, a Dutch fusilier stopped by to purchase his weekly supply of tobacco. In normal circumstances, it would count for nothing that this man was part of the ruling foreign engine work of the Indies. The merchants of Serang were ecumenical in their pursuit of trade, and the tobacco seller, like everyone else, would happily accept the custom of anyone, brown, yellow, or, as in this case, the white European from the curiously privileged group who ruled over them. But these were not normal circumstances. All of a sudden there seemed to be a curious feeling of tension in the air. The Dutch had been aware of it for some days now. There was a kind of muted resentment, a vague hostility that made people look away or mutter among themselves in hushed tones whenever a Dutch official happened by. Perhaps they were imagining things. After all, the Krakatoa relief operations, all organised by the Dutch, were now in full swing. Dutch money was pouring into the area, shelters were being built, roads were being cleared, businesses were being reopened. The Dutch Governor-General himself, aboard the steam yacht the King of the Netherlands, had paid an official visit. The local people had every reason, one would have thought, to be grateful for the colonists' help in the speed of their programme of rescue and rebuilding. It wasn't the fault of the Dutch that the tragedy had happened, but, without a murmur of complaint, the Dutch were quite generously helping the people who were worst affected. True, the relief efforts organised from Rotterdam and Amsterdam were more concerned with ensuring that Dutch-owned businesses were able to stagger back onto their feet, but if the native people derived benefit as a result, well, that was in part what colonialism was all about, surely, and they thus had ample reason to look kindly on their faraway benefactors, n'est-ce pas? But then, here in Serang, the unimaginable happened. It was while the young soldier was in the process of handing over a fistful of guilders for a package of fine-cured and locally grown tobacco with which to pack his pipe, that a bearded man, dressed entirely in white and armed with a curved dagger, suddenly threw himself on him and began stabbing him repeatedly in the back. The astonished fusilier, gravely wounded, managed to stagger into a nearby Chinese shop. The attacker, his task completed to his satisfaction, ran away and was soon lost in the throng. The market was thrown into chaos. Nothing like this had happened before. Troops from the garrison, one of the five in Java's first military region and one of the smaller, immediately flooded into the area and promptly arrested a number of known malcontents. But none could be proven to have been the attacker. The would-be assassin seemed to have gotten away with it. Then, 6 weeks later, much the same thing happened once again. Another young man, also dressed ostentatiously in white robes, somehow managed to infiltrate the garrison headquarters itself, and when he was challenged, brandished a long knife and slightly wounded a locally raised sentry named Umar Jaman. The attacker was this time captured and interrogated. Military investigators, bewildered by the man's confusing answers to their questions, suggested in their report that the motive for his assault was an inexplicable case of extreme religious zeal. To the local military commander, the attacks were unprecedented and sinister. True, there had only been two of them, and they might well have been perpetrated by the same deranged man, though the assailant held in custody in November refused to confirm that he had also carried out the October incident. But two attacks or not, it seemed to the puzzled soldiery, and to those already aware of the sullen mood, that there had been an unexplained outbreak of a weirdly fanatical anger, and that it was for some reason directed specifically against the Dutch masters. It would be prudent, the soldiers suggested to their political masters, that the authorities from henceforth be permanently on their guard. They were right to be careful. The events in Serang that autumn turned out to be the beginnings of a long and exceptionally violent period in Western Java, a period that culminated in a memorably dangerous and politically ominous rebellion that erupted 5 years later in 1888. The Banten Peasants' Revolt, as the episode is now generally known, is thought by many today to be one of the turning points in the region's colonial history, one of the more important milestones on the road leading to the eventual expulsion of the Europeans in 1949 and the creation of modern independent Indonesia. There had been many small rebellions in Java over the years, but what happened in Banten had a significance that transcended many of the other outbreaks of violence and hostility. For what took place among the population of the northwestern tip of Java between 1883 and 1888 was not, however, of political significance alone. The time also had great religious significance, since it marked a period when Islam, and for one of the first times, had become both fully entwined with the local political developments of the day and, so many scholars now accept, had begun actually to dictate at least some of the major political developments of the period. It wasn't the first time, of course. In India, the Mughal rulers had become amply caught up in the politics of the subcontinent, and in Spain too, ever since the Arab governor of Tangier had invaded via Gibraltar in AD 711, and Arabs were to run large tracts of that peninsula for much of the next four centuries, Islam had wielded enormous power in southern Europe too. In the East Indies, matters proceeded rather differently. A close look at these 5 years, particularly among the unusually pious people of Banten, shows clearly the beginnings of militant and anti-Western Islamic movements, movements spawned in Java, but which have since become so important a feature of the realpolitik of the modern world. An examination of the events that began with this pair of attacks on the colonial military in the autumn of 1883 suggests that the driving force behind most of the subsequent violent events in West Java, and which were prefigured by the bearded men in white acting out of their extreme religious zeal, was without a doubt fundamentalist, militant and anti-colonial, anti-infidel Mohammedanism.